Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The first time I heard of Cook's Illustrated magazine was one night, 1994. I was sweating bullets over a steaming pot of risotto, and I couldn't figure out why it wouldn't finish cooking. We were celebrating New Year's Eve that night with three other couples, and one of my friends stood by silently, and then she finally asked if I had altered the recipe in any way. And I said, well, yeah, I doubled it. She said, well, that might be the problem. I said, how do you know? How do you know? She said, well, she learned that from Cook's Illustrated and recommended I check it out. And I have been ever since. I'm a big fan, so you can imagine my pleasure today in welcoming Chris Kimball to the show. Lucky us, just in time for the holiday cooking spree. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how are you?
Thanks for being here. Chris is founder and editor of Cook's Illustrated, Cook's Country Magazine, and Cook's Country Magazines, and he's also the host of the popular PBS show America's Test Kitchen, and now also Cook's Country. Right, Chris? Is that the name of the new show?
Yeah, just an excuse to spend more time in Vermont. Everything I do has a personal side.
Well,
so, yes.
It's a beautiful home. but is that new, or was it ended for a while and came back on the air, or is it brand new?
No, the Cook's Country show started a year ago. We just filmed the third season in September, and we film it actually in Vermont. It's an old farmhouse that my wife and I bought years ago. So it's a real thing. It's not a set.
Exactly. It's a real thing. You can see through the windows, and you have an audience there that participates.
Well, people actually, here's what's so interesting about television. Huh. Many people come up to me, and they think it's fake. They think the view out the window is like some painted backdrop, you know?
We're well trained.
Studio in Manhattan. So I was going to say, you know, I should just like walk through the background of the show or something just to prove to people it's real. But it is, it's a real view.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. Have someone wave through the window or something.
Well, I told the test kitchen they should just run naked behind the kitchen, the window. And that would prove to everybody that we actually are there. That suggestion did not meet with much enthusiasm.
Only in Vermont, right? So.
Well, you know, streaking is actually one of my daughters is at college in Vermont, and the first night she was there, the streaking club got busy. So I guess it is a very Vermont thing to do.
They're still streaking. That's almost, you know, 70s.
I think streaking is really big when it's cold out. You know, I think there's some, if it's snow or ice on the ground, people streak. It's the reverse logic thing. I don't know.
Well, you know, I put out the message on Facebook and Twitter asking people for questions to ask you today, knowing that they would be very interested. I got a lot of different responses, but a lot of them had to do with, of course, the Thanksgiving dinner. So we could just get started with that. And if anyone out there listening right now has a question or comment, wants to speak with Chris Kimball, call 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Chris, how soon do you start preparing Thanksgiving dinner?
I'm going up tomorrow. The good thing about Thanksgiving is it's hunting season. It's rifle season. And so I split my time between sitting in the tree stand in the rain and cooking. And so we'll start Tuesday doing a lot of the cooking. I do almost all of it on a wood cook stove. The turkey is from my neighbor Jean, who lives across the road, and she raises three birds a year. Their names are always the same: Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter. But you know, it's funny. She used to do these old heritage breeds, and it turns out that those birds have these huge legs. I mean, it's ludicrous. They're just like 2 feet long, and almost no breast meat. So last year, she came over the day before. I brined the bird overnight, and then I have, as I said, a wood cook stove. Well, I had to sort of like cut the ends of the legs off to get it in because they were so huge. So we had a dark meat Thanksgiving. So this year I think she's got a more current breed, so there's a better balance of white to dark.
It's mentioned, you know, you can send away for those heritage birds
by
mail order.
This drives me nuts. You know, look, it's like heirloom apples.
Right.
A lot of heirloom apples are heirloom because they were terrible. I mean, some of them were – they were grainy. They had tough skin. They didn't last very well. They didn't store well. You know, they tasted like nuts instead of apples. So there's nothing inherently good about something that's old-fashioned. I mean, it sounds good. On the other hand, there were lots of wonderful, you know, turkey breeds and apples and other things that were great. But just because it's heirloom or heritage doesn't guarantee it's better. It just means it's older.
One thing is for sure, what we get in the grocer's freezer and refrigerator is not what we think of as turkeys running around the barnyard.
No, if you actually are, you know, we go turkey hunting, and if you've ever had wild turkey, you know that it's a totally different animal in all respects. And actually, the dark meat, the legs are actually very, you'd have to really cook them low and slow for a very long time to make them edible. So I think there have been some actual improvements. I wouldn't really want to eat a wild turkey. For that reason, I think some heritage breeds that are a nice mix, breeding does improve sometimes the meat, and so that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I'm not a big fan of the butterball because they're injected with a brine, the frozen ones are, and they have almost no texture and almost no flavor. But as a friend of mine once said, that's why God invented gravy. It's like veal. You know, it has no taste. It's just it's there for things
to go with
top of it. And, you know what? That's fine. At Thanksgiving, everybody has taste memories. And so people they want what they remember, really. And that's fine. I have no problem with a frozen butterball because if people are used to it, that's fine.
So, right. Yeah. It's kind of iconic. You know, it's one of our listeners does it by they must be listening online because they're from Michigan, and they wanted to know how to cook deer meat to have it not have that game taste. And he mentions that in the state of Michigan, a lot of people are hunting more this year to help offset the food costs. So many of them, you know, are struggling with unemployment, and he thought it might be a big help to people to know that.
Well, it's just like I just spent a long time trying to figure out how to cook a goose, and it's the same thing. You really got to separate the tenderloin, for example, from the rest of it. So the tenderloin can be cooked over very high heat, like any tenderloin, and cook it to rare or medium rare. You can throw it on a grill, you can put it in a 450 oven, whatever. And so that's one part of it. Then if you get to the tougher stuff, that's going to have to be cooked low and slow. Marinating does not soften meat at all.
Okay.
It can add flavor. But I would braise it or cook it in a very slow oven for a long period of time or stew it. You know, a lot of my neighbors use crock pots and cube venison for that. It's very lean meat. So you're going to have to cook it low and slow and not overcook it. The tenderloin, however, can be cooked very quickly over very high heat.
You know, braising something I'm finally just getting the hang of and getting. I just braised some pork chops the other night and they were wonderful. It was great. It's a sort of a new technique for me. It sounded, as you said, old-fashioned, and how good could it be in a way? A lot of what you guys do, though, is bring up those old-fashioned ideas and bring them back to life.
Well, braising, there's an interesting history to braising. Braising was invented because people were cooking over a wood fire, and they had a roast, for example, in a pan or pieces of meat in a pan, and they would burn, so they added liquid. And that's a lot of people think is the beginning of braising. So the liquid is put in just to stop the meat from burning over the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Braising doesn't affect the meat itself. That is, if you stew meat, if you boil meat, if you braise it, if you roast it in dry heat, you'll end up with exactly the same thing at the end of the day as long as the internal temperature is the same. So there's no steam coming off, which is penetrating the meat. I mean, a lot of people had this theory that somehow the liquid turned to steam and that changed the cooking process. It doesn't have anything to do with that. What it does do is it gives you a sauce.
Mm-hmm.
So braising just means cooking meat or poultry or vegetables for that matter, usually in a closed container with a small amount of liquid, and that liquid is then usually defatted and turned into a sauce. So it's a way of providing a sauce at the same time. But you can boil. I actually did this. I took pot roast, chuck eye or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and boiled them, braised them, and roasted them. And at the end of the day, they were pretty much the same.
You know, this recipe for the pork chops was recommended because it was the sort of thing you could make the night or two nights before and then reheat, and it would taste good. And a lot of it did have to do with the sauce that went with it.
Yes, a lot of pie roasts, we do that and let it chill overnight. If you take it out of the liquid, then the fat congeals on top.
Right.
You take the fat off, which is great. Then you slice it and reheat it in the sauce, and it's delicious.
You know, my producer, Linda Taylor, mentioned something she saw on the latest show from Cook's Country, and I watched it again this morning, and I tried it the other night, though, just from listening to her, and it was braising the potatoes for mashing the potatoes to make mashed potatoes.
We do that with sweet potatoes, and instead of boiling them or roasting them, you just put them in a big pan, saucepan, and you add a little bit of cream, a little bit of a brown sugar to that, and you add butter, and you cook them For half an hour or so, you cut them into pieces and obviously peel them. And then you mash them right in the pan.
Right.
And the benefit is you don't lose all the flavor of the water, and you get a great texture. So it's essentially 90% sweet potatoes and just a little bit of butter and cream and sugar, but it's delicious. It's the best way to cook them.
Oh, it's fantastic. Plus, it was a one-pan dish, and I could mash them right in there, and it was a lot easier to mash them in the pan, the big frying pan I was using, than to do it in a bowl or something like that, because the mashers, of course, most of them at least, are flat. They don't curve.
And you also don't have to take up your oven for over an hour roasting them, or you don't lose, as I said, all the flavor.
All the flavor. Yeah, they were good.
Great.
Another thing, that I enjoyed and I'm going to try this year. Well, I think a lot of people are going to get that 29-cent a pound turkey this year. They can't afford much more than that, and it's great that they're out there in a way. But how do you dress those babies up?
Well, here's the problem of being in the food publishing business. Mm-hmm. Every fall, you have to come up with a turkey recipe. So I've been coming up with turkey recipes every year, and you really have to find new ways of doing it. So we brine them. Again, a frozen butter ball is brined, essentially. It's injected with
And people should check their turkey to make sure that it's, yeah.
Yeah, if it's a kosher bird, if it's a frozen butter ball, they're already brined. If they're not brined, here's the rule. 1 cup of table salt per gallon of water, 6 to 8 hours. If you want to do it overnight, I would use 1/2 cup of table salt per gallon of water, and make sure it's kept in a cool environment. I have a big root cellar, which is fine, but if you don't, you don't have room in your refrigerator, which most people don't, get a big cooler and put the brine in with the turkey and then throw a bunch of ice packs in it. And that way it'll keep it cool. If you're using kosher salt, I double the amount of salt. So kosher salt would be 2 cups of kosher salt per gallon of water. That's the first thing. The second thing, and my favorite way of doing it, is to, you don't have to brine the bird, but you use salt pork. And you use strips of salt pork, and you put that on top of the bird. And then on top of that, you have some cheesecloth that you've soaked in water for 10, 15 minutes. And on top of that, you put some aluminum foil on, and you roast it in about a 325 oven. And once you get the bird up to like 140 or so, crank the oven to 425, 450, take everything off the top, and finish skin side up to crisp it. It's called barding, B-A-R-D-I-N-G. It's an old technique. James Beard in American Cookery used it. And instead of larding, where you're inserting salt pork, it just lies on top. Oh, what a flavor. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just phenomenal. And, of course, salt pork has salt, which sort of acts like a brine or a salt, so that also helps. But it's phenomenal flavor. I think it's the best turkey I ever had.
One little detail, you want to poke holes in the top of it so that it goes somewhere. It goes right into it and doesn't run off the side. And also, it's not a substitute for bacon. Or bacon is not a substitute for salt pork.
No, salt pork, I mean, salt pork is mostly fat. It's really fat back that's been salted. And it gives you obviously a lot of fat, and it also gives you a lot of flavor, and it doesn't give you, it's not a smoky, flavor like bacon.
Right. We got to take a quick break. My guest today, Chris Kimball, editor of Cooks Illustrated, Cook's Country, host of the Cook's Country show, and also America's Test Kitchen on PBS. Give us a call. I know you're out there. You have questions. 614-292-8513 or email us, allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Join us this afternoon at 1 o'clock for On Point, Google versus Murdoch. Google versus Murdoch, Rupert Murdoch wants to block the search giant from scooping free content from his newspapers. On Point looks at the showdown. That discussion on Point at 1 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 46 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20, on our way to a high of 53 today, with a slight chance of rain this afternoon. Cloudy with a good chance of evening rain and a low of 40 degrees. Sunshine for Friday and a high of 52. For Saturday, partly cloudy and a high of 57.
Support for WOSU comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts, presenting the improvisational comedy stylings of Chicago City Limits Friday, November 20th at 7:30 at the McCoy Center for the Arts in New Albany. More at McCoyCenterForTheArts.com.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today, Chris Kimball. He's the editor of Cooks Illustrated, Cooks Country magazines, and also the host of America's Test Kitchen. If you have a question, comment for Chris, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have some callers, but they're still getting their questions together. Chris, back to the turkey. One person sent me a message. They asked, wet brine versus dry brine?
We've done both. The advantage of a dry brine is just salting. It's a little more fussy because you have to get the salt into the meat, and the preparation takes a little more time. The only advantage of the dry salting is that you don't get quite that wet texture that you get, but it's much easier just to use a wet brine. You just mix it up, throw it in, and you're done. And 6 hours later, you're finished. So, all things being equal, I would go with a wet brine.
Yeah, and I've done it in the cooler, and it's once I figured that one out, it made a big difference. Someone wanted to know about what do you think about cooking the turkey in an oven bag? I've never done it.
Well, the oven bags we actually use for hams, especially spiral sliced hams. They're great, and for that technique, we actually buy one of those turkeys, leave it in the plastic, put it in hot tap water for 45 minutes, and then throw the water out, put in more water, so it's an hour and a half. It brings it up to room temperature, and then you put it in a low oven, cook it to about 100 degrees in the bag, take the bag off, crank the oven till it's hot, and finish with some sort of glaze. But with a turkey, the problem with the oven bag is the skin doesn't get rendered properly and crisped up. So the bag's great for the white meat because it stays moist.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like Adele Davis back in the 60s. She slow roasted everything at very low oven temperatures. And you can do that with turkey, but most people like turkey skin. And so either low roasting or the oven bag isn't going to do much for the skin.
That reminds me of that scene from Accidental Tourist.
Tourist, yes, I love that. Yeah. She's trying to kill everybody.
That was a great scene. I know, I agree. Another person wants to know, does injecting a turkey with butter improve the taste and tenderness?
Injecting with a brine is fine. The butter, usually what we do is it's easier to simply do a flavored butter, and you can put that between the skin over the breast meat and the legs and the meat itself. So a flavored butter between the skin and the meat actually works fine.
Okay, we got a call. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Jay, you're on the air. Hi, Jay.
Yeah. Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. Chris, I have a Weber Smoky Mountain smoker, and I was going to try to smoke a turkey this Thanksgiving.
Yep.
And I wondered if what you thought about that or if you've ever tried something like that.
Yeah, I've done that. I used we Fenn electric smokers are pretty convenient, but I use the old charcoal kind. And I could do two turkeys at a time, and I believe when I set it up, it took about 10 hours. I would set up about 6 in the morning, and then by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it would be done. This is a large turkey. I think it's great. It's and it's a lot easier than deep frying it.
About a 20-pound turkey, you think would take about 10 hours? Or?
As I remember it, I haven't done it in a few years, but it was about 10 hours, and this is a charcoal setup. So, Yeah, I mean, the good news about the smokers was that I added the fuel and then I was done. You just walked away. If you're doing it on a Weber or something else, you're probably going to have to keep adding charcoal and fussing with it. But the smokers do a nice job. So I think it's pretty much an all-day affair, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Jay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. My experience with the Weber, my folks did it for the first time back in the 70s, and they didn't know that it would take so long. I think we ate dinner that night about 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, been picking at the stuffing all day, but we didn't get the turkey till late.
Yeah, I'm a fan of just the straight turkey.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like to fool around at Thanksgiving. I'll fool around the day after and the day before, but I like my traditions on Thanksgiving.
All right, me too. What about the pros and cons of butterfly turkey? For me, one of the traditions is the presentation, but you know, there's pros and cons when you do butterfly chicken. So what about turkey?
No, we've done that, and that's a great way to do it. What we did was we butterflied it, which simply means take the backbone out and then flatten it. You know, you essentially crack the breastbone. And you can cook it at very high temperature because the dark meat and the white meat are going to end up being cooking about the same rate. With a normal turkey that's not butterfly, the dark meat's hidden a little bit, and the breast meat's exposed more. So it solves that problem.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing we did is we did it on a rack over a roasting pan, and in the roasting pan was a stuffing. So as the turkey roasted, butterflied, and it cooked in like 2 hours. It was like a 450 oven. The juices ran down into the stuffing, and that was great because you can't hold much stuffing in a bird. Plus, the other problem with stuffing is it usually takes longer to bring the stuffing up to 160, which is the safe temperature, than it does to get the dark meat and the white meat cooked. So by the time the stuffing's ready, you've overcooked the breast meat.
You can take it out, though, and continue cooking the stuffing, right?
Well, the better way to do it is you can get these stuffing bags and put the stuffing in the bag, throw in the microwave, get it up to like 130 or 140
mm-hmm.
in the microwave, and then obviously not using your bare hands, putting it, you know, stuffing the turkey with the stuffing in the bag, and then you get a head start to the stuffing, and then you don't have to worry about it.
Oh, okay.
That's what I would do.
Last year I finally found a recipe that for stuffing outside of the turkey that really worked. It was fantastic. I loved it. Everybody raved, and of course I've lost the recipe. I've been looking around for it frantically. Any ideas about that?
Yeah, that's what we do. But you have to use more liquid in the recipe. You can't take a recipe that's for a stuffed bird and then just cook it separately
mm-hmm.
because those recipes depend upon the juices from the bird helping to moisten the stuffing. So you're going to have to add chicken stock or whatever it is. You're going to have to start with a slightly wetter stuffing. I would also do a cover in a roasting pan, cover with foil. In the last 10 or 15 minutes, I would take the foil off and just crisp the top.
And I don't think there's any substitute for using fresh bread instead of the kinds you buy.
Do not use the bag of
right.
stuffing with the croutons and everything.
Right.
It's not hard to make. You know, stuffings used to be, they use anything because they had leftovers. They could use rice. They could use any kind of cooked grain.
Mm-hmm.
They could use bread. And that's why, you know, in the old days, there was a lot of stale bread sitting around, and that's why they made bread pudding. And that's why they made stuffing. It's just a way to use up leftovers. So there's nothing wrong with stale bread. You can stale it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in an oven for a few minutes. But, stale bread is great for a stuffing base. Still works.
Yeah, I guess I meant fresh bread staled because I don't have a lot of stale bread. Yeah.
That sounds like a biography.
Freshly staled.
I'll write that. It's a good title.
One of my friends on Facebook wanted to know, and it's a great question, how a chef pulls together the prep for large numbers of people and pulls it all together. And he wondered if you had any suggestions for serving
sure.
a large crowd. I'm doing 15 myself, so I'm all ears.
Well, my first suggestion doesn't work on Thanksgiving, which is make the menu really simple. And anytime I've cooked with someone who's cooked all their life, they inevitably are cooking a couple of things, you know, like a soup or a stew, and there's some bread. So they keep the menu simple. Thanksgiving, that's useless advice because you can't not cook something that someone wants. So the first thing you do is you read all the recipes thoroughly, and you make sure you have the ingredients, which sounds stupid, but
mm-hmm.
inevitably people don't. And what I do when I cook, and we do here at the Test Kitchen here in Boston, is we prep everything ahead of time. We buy cheap plastic cafeteria trays.
Mm-hmm.
And we have little bowls, glass bowls of different sizes. Everything is measured and prepped and cut and minced and pressed and everything else. It's all, and then we look at the recipe and figure out which things go together. So you can put a number of things in the same bowl. You get that all organized, and you take a Xerox copy or print out of the recipe and put that on top of the tray. So when you go to cook, everything's ready and it's all set. What most people do is they prep as they go. And there's nothing worse than cooking a recipe, and then it says add two mm-hmm. a tablespoon of minced garlic, and meanwhile the onions are burning.
Right.
You got to go find the garlic. You got to mince them. You know, so everything is prepped ahead of time. And if you do that, and then also figure out your oven times and what you have to do when, it makes cooking 100 times simpler. Because if you prep as you go, you'll make mistakes, and it's very difficult. The cooking itself is easy. most of the work is the prep and the cleanup.
Yeah,
it's all about prep.
And on a holiday, you might not be able to go out and find the ingredients if you've forgotten to buy them. So if you're not preparing them ahead of time or not inventorying them ahead of time.
Well, people also make the mistake. I see it all the time because we send our recipes out for our readers to make them and then comment on them before we publish them. I would say 99% of the time people substitute ingredients, and they don't realize, for example, natural cocoa powder and Dutch cocoa powder react differently because one has more acid in it than another. Or they think dark brown sugar and light brown sugar are the same thing. Or, you know, so they end up making substitutes that really make a huge difference in the recipe. You know, someone uses a top plate steak instead of using steak tips, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So you really want to not do that because sometimes it makes no difference, but sometimes it completely ruins a recipe, especially in baking. So and people wonder why, you know, for example, about a year ago, a guy wrote, you know, well, I tried your chicken breast recipe. I really didn't like it very much. I wouldn't make it again. It was very disappointing. And then at the end, we have a questionnaire. We asked any comments. He said, yeah, he said, you know, I didn't have chicken. This is a chicken breast recipe. I didn't have chicken, so I used shrimp instead. And so you go like, no, of course they were overcooked. You cook shrimp for half an hour.
How did you find this guy? You gave him the recipe.
Yeah, he was one of our testers, you know. And so if I know it sounds stupid, but if you just read the recipe slowly, prep ahead of time, get it all organized, your chances of success are about 10 times higher. And it just makes all the difference in the world being organized.
Yeah, and when I was going back to my first issue from November, December 1994, in your column, you wrote about taste testing pasta at a restaurant in New York. And you said you surprised yourself when your favorite one turned out to be the mass market brand. And you said that after reflection, it occurred to you that the tasting went a long way to make the basic point of the magazine, which is that firsthand experience counts for a lot. And you wanted to talk about the ability to let our palates decide for themselves is the essence of being American. It's sort of the American way. But you have to know, and that's what's great about Cook's Illustrated, is it's very step-by-step, and they do all the experimentation for you.
Well, look, everybody gets in the kitchen, in the car here, everybody wants to be an artist, and they think that the essence of being a good cook is to improvise. Well, it's just like any other, like being a musician, you know. You got to practice the scales day in, day out, day in, day out. And then improvisation comes on top of a lot of experience and knowledge. So nothing embarrassing about following a recipe.
Mm-hmm.
I follow recipes all the time. So this whole idea of being creative in the kitchen, I think, is oversold. Creativity only comes because people are deeply familiar with a style of recipe or ingredients. You know, in Italy, they weren't improvising recipes all the time. They were making the same recipes their grandmothers did. So I'm not a big fan of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you made a recipe 5 or 10 times and you're really familiar with it and you want to start fooling with it, that's fine. But there's this impetus to do it your way, you know, or it's sort of mm-hmm. like the McDonald's commercial, you know, something, or McBurger King, have it your way. So, you know, just follow the recipe the mm-hmm. first time. There's nothing embarrassing about it. And then if you want to fool with it from then on, that's fine. But it turns out that cooking, everyone says cooking is subjective. Well, sure. I mean, if you like nutmeg versus cinnamon in a cookie, that's subjective. But most of cooking is very objective. That is, there are rules.
Mm-hmm.
There's thousands of rules about what works and what doesn't. You know, cake flour versus all-purpose versus bread flour, tough cuts of meat, expensive cuts of meat, high roasting, low roasting. All this stuff actually is, there are scientific, how flambés work. All of that's scientific, and it actually means something. On top of that, you can have different desires in terms of taste. You like this, you don't like that. But the fundamentals of cooking are completely objective. Once you know those things, then you can play with your food. But until you know that, you should probably follow the recipe to get the hang of it.
Well, it's nice in Cook's Illustrated, though. What I always loved about it was how you present variations on that theme for the reader. You know, for the people who are following it. So, yeah, you can experiment a little bit with certain things, and you tell them what they can work with. But so that you can expand the idea of it to suit your own tastes or what you have in your cupboard, but it doesn't change the chemistry of it. So, you know, how often do you return to recipes to reassess them? How do you do that?
When our readers send us a piece of email or a letter and saying, look, I made you something that didn't work, That would definitely okay. prompt us to go back. I would say that's rarely happened, but we go back for two reasons. We'll go back if it's a brownie recipe and we want to do a variation on it. You know, mm-hmm. there's like 10 different kinds of brownies. So we might do a cheesecake brownie instead of a cakey brownie. But we have gone back. We did creme brulee years ago when we first got started in the 90s. And it turns out the recipe actually had some problems. Someone called and said they had a problem. We made it. We had a problem. So we went back and had to re-engineer it. So occasionally we'll go back. Or, you know, we learn something new. For example, pie crust. I love making pies. And mm-hmm. about 2 years ago, I said to the staff, you know, this is ridiculous. Every time I make a pie, it comes out differently. Every time you make a pie, it comes out differently. We need to find a way to solve the problem. And we did. And we came up with a recipe that uses half water, half vodka.
In the pie crust?
Yeah, it's the most interesting recipe we've ever done. It turns out the problem with pie crust is you don't want to add too much water, as recipes say, mm-hmm. because it'll make the crust tough, which is true. Mm-hmm. So people don't add enough water, and then they can't roll it out because it's too dry. And everyone this coming Thursday, you know, whenever, is going to have that problem. So how do you have a lot of moisture in it to roll it out, but you still end up with a flaky pie crust? And the answer is vodka. Vodka is about 47% alcohol. That alcohol will burn off in the oven.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So you can add extra liquid to start with, so you have a nice soft dough, which is easy to work with. But when it bakes, some of that liquid, the alcohol, disappears, and you end up with a very flaky, light crust. It's brilliant. That wasn't my idea.
How did they ever come to that idea? I mean, they just started thinking of the chemistry again.
Yeah, he called. We have an on-call scientist, Guy Crosby, who works with us all the time. We called him, and we explained the problem. He said, well, you know, alcohol, you know, vodka or gin or something is about half alcohol. It's 100 proof. And that should work. And so we tested and it worked. So we'll go back to something when we were more experienced, and we go back to solve a problem that we sort of solved, but we have a better solution. So we'll do that.
We're going to take another quick break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Give us a call. You know, I know you're out there. You have questions. It's also fun just to listen. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820, NPR News.
This is Capital City Radio.
I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is The World.
And this is Capital City Radio.
If you want me to stay, I'll be around today to be available for you.
Capital City Radio is the center of music and news. The new service from WOSU. Online at capitalcityradio.org. And good morning. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about issues affecting the transgender community in Central Ohio and the Transgender Day of Remembrance to mourn and honor victims of hate crimes. That discussion begins at 11 o'clock right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Currently 47 degrees in downtown Columbus. At 10:40, cloudy skies today, a slight chance of rain throughout the day and a high of 53. Clouds tonight and a good chance of evening rain, a low of 40 degrees. Sunshine for Friday and a high of 52, partly cloudy on Saturday and a high of 57. On your way home, get perspective on all the day's news with All Things Considered and the business news on Marketplace. Weekdays starting at 4, now on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News and Classical Music. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today, Chris Kimball. He is the founder, editor of Cook's Illustrated and Cook's Country Magazines, and also he's the host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS. We have some calls now. If you'd like to call and ask him a question, 614-292-8513. And we take emails, allsides@wosu.org. Martin, you're on the air. You have an idea about that crust.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to say I've been doing that for years. But I use, like, for apple pie, spiced rum over ice cubes. And why not try and sneak a little bit more flavor instead of just vodka? But I just wanted to say your method for doing tomatoes to make a tomato soup, putting with salt and pepper and brown sugar under the broiler. I put all my tomatoes up this year by doing that, and basically either roasting them really high with salt, pepper, brown sugar, and sometimes some other seasonings, and letting that go, collecting the liquid underneath, putting them in a strainer, getting more liquid, and having these fire-roasted tomatoes that I just froze, plus you get this tomato juice that's a roasted tomato broth that's just an incredible ingredient. Anyhow, so those are just two things that are takeoffs on that. I was wondering, I have a vacuum seal, and I know there is a style of cooking, I can't remember the French name for it, but that involves vacuum sealing ingredients.
Yeah, sous vide. Sous vide is the technique.
And I wonder, I've not tried it, but do you have anything about that?
Yeah, sous vide was very popular about 20 years ago. I remember going to a couple demonstrations of it, and they used it. The reason they used it commercially was they thought they could get very upscale food. It would be packaged in a vacuum bag, essentially, and then simply reheated in simmering water. For commercial uses, I guess it's fine. I wouldn't think it really has much application for people at home. But it was like a museum restaurant, for example, where someone else would supply the food and it would be easy to heat up. So that's what it was used for. I don't think it really gained much traction, though.
So,
by the way, the tomato soup idea, I love that recipe, which, as you said, is roasting canned tomatoes with salt, pepper, and a little brown sugar, and it makes a fabulous soup.
I did it with the fresh tomatoes in abundance out of my garden, and it was just fabulous. It's just a fabulous product, and to have these little frozen, and it concentrates the tomatoes down tremendously. Mm-hmm. And then I froze them in muffin tins so that I can pull them out and use them as an ingredient. It's really the best I've ever done.
Thanks.
Martin,
thanks
for your call. Thank you. Let's see. Katie, you're on the air. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking the call.
You're welcome.
My question is about making mashed potatoes in advance. Another woman and I cook for our families together. And we did it last year, and it was a success. We put the mashed potatoes in a crock pot. And I'm not really, neither of us are really quite sure what we did to make it a success, and I'm wondering if Chris can maybe give us some advice on that.
That's exactly right. You can make mashed potatoes ahead. The crock pot's the perfect thing for them, which you could also reheat them over simmering water or in a double boiler. And just add a little more liquid milk or cream at the end because they do tend to dry out a little bit. Mashed potatoes do, in fact, work great ahead, and the slow cooker or crock pot's a great way to do it.
Thank you, Katie. Let's see. Marcia, you have a question about deep frying the turkey, I guess? Marcia?
Yes.
Hi.
Yes. Hi, Ann and Christopher. This is probably a sacrilege to even talk to you about this, Chris, but I have two very good friends, both of whom are great cooks, and they are going to use one of those turkey fryers this year to do their Thanksgiving turkey. And I just wondered your opinion on them. I think you vaguely referred to it earlier and not in a real good way.
I've done it myself, not for Thanksgiving. I did it one summer outside in Vermont. It's good. The only thing I would say about it is it's incredibly messy and dangerous. But the thing I don't like about it is the skin. Once the skin cools off an hour after you cook it, the skin is awful. It's really nasty. So if you eat it right away, it's fine. But if you like turkey skin, once it starts to cool down, it's really pretty bad. So that would be the only thing I don't like about it. So, but you can certainly do it, and make sure you do it outside somewhere where you're not going to burn the house down or kill yourself.
Thanks, Marcia,
for
the question.
It's good.
Aman, you're on the air. Oops, sorry. Aman, you're on the air.
Yes. Oh, hello. Christopher. I'm Aman, and I'm a kind of a Cooks Illustrated fanatic, and there's something I've always wondered, which is in some kind of Italian recipes, you call for crushed tomatoes. And in some recipes, you call for diced tomatoes that you put in the food processor. And I've always wondered, why not just use crushed tomatoes? Like, why put diced tomatoes in the food processor?
You're a very observant guy. We've had this internal raging debate. It drives me crazy. I totally agree with you. We've gone through these phases. It's sort of like, you know, being a teenager, you know, and you change your mind every 6 months. Generally speaking, we like tomatoes not packed in puree, packed in natural liquids, and so that's fine. The diced tomatoes have calcium carbonate to keep them keep the pieces whole. So we do find that when you cook them, like if you want to make a sauce, the pieces never break down. That's the only problem with diced tomatoes. So to solve that problem, I guess sometimes if we want a smooth product, we do put them in a food processor. Crushed tomatoes, though, if it's a good brand, packed in natural juices, I like what's the brand in the cans that have the coating? Muir Glen and
right.
I think also Progressive or Red Pack do pretty well. You can use crushed tomatoes instead of
okay.
I think it's six of one
after one
the other.
That's one substitute that's okay. Okay.
Yeah,
thank you very
no
much.
Problem.
Thanks for the call.
And I love your publication, too. Awesome.
Thank you.
Bye.
Adam, you want to talk about turducken?
I do.
Okay. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was just looking for if you had any tips on making a successful turducken.
Yes, don't.
Don't? Come on.
Please don't. We tested them here. Oh, boy. We bought a bunch of them 3 or 4 years ago, and I would stick with a turkey if I were you. We were not big fans.
What is a turducken?
It's a number of things put together,
uh-huh.
And we found, you know, it's sort of like the medieval concept of stuffing one thing in another,
uh-huh.
and we found that they were not great. You know, it's got a great name.
Yeah.
It's a chicken stuffed in a duck stuffed in a turkey.
Yeah, it's just don't go there.
Okay.
just get a good turkey roasted. And you'll be much better off.
All right.
Thanks, Adam.
All
thanks
right,
for helping us clear that one up. Bruno, you wanted to go back to the brine solution issue. Hi, Bruno. You're on the air.
Yeah, I tuned in kind of late, and I didn't get the like the recipe for the brine solution you were talking.
Yeah, 1 cup of table salt per gallon of water. And if you're using kosher salt, like Diamond Crystal kosher salt, you'd use 2 cups of kosher salt per gallon of water.
Mm-hmm.
Kosher salt has bigger crystals and weighs less per cup than table salt. Make sure, though, the turkey's kept somewhere that's cool, preferably around 40 degrees or under 40, and just use a big cooler with ice packs or if you don't have room in the refrigerator.
Yeah, there's no.
And it's 6 to 8 hours, by the way, 6 to 8 hours. If you're going to do it overnight for 10 or 12 hours, I cut the salt in half.
Okay.
But there's no sugar in the solution, in the brine
solution?
No,
you don't need sugar. No, no,
mm-hmm.
Not for this. You can add some if you want, but it's just salt and water.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Bruno.
You're welcome.
And Julie, you're on the air. You want to ask about pie crusts?
Yeah, I just have a suggestion about how I make pie crusts. Instead of using a rolling pin and flour, I use saran wrap. And so I never add more flour than what the recipe called for. So my pie crusts have come out very flaky and I think delicious. But I do have a question as well. I have a new Gen Air gas stove and range, and for the last 10 years, I have been using Barbara Kafka's way of roasting turkeys, which is at a very high
very
heat.
Very high temperature.
Mm-hmm, 500 degrees.
Yep.
And like in the past, I do a 16, 17-pound turkey in 2 hours, which I love. Now, with this new Gen Air, last year's turkey came out very dry, and I always use the same recipe, so I'm assuming it was the new gas stove and not something I did. I don't know.
Well, there are two possibilities. One is I've used that recipe for chicken, her similar recipe. You definitely want a brined bird or, you know, a frozen butter ball that's been brined. It's not going to be great.
Oh,
if you were using a frozen frozen butterball, which is essentially brined,
uh-huh.
her recipe will work. If you're using a bird that's not brined and you don't brine it, it's going to be dried out because the breast meat's going to get torched.
Okay.
So that could be the difference. The other thing you want to do is buy a Taylor oven thermometer. They're about $12
mm-hmm.
so.
Mm-hmm.
Make absolutely sure that your oven's calibrated properly. I found you buy a new oven, the odds of it being properly calibrated are pretty close to zero.
It
could be 50 degrees off or even 75 degrees off, so you might want to check that.
Okay, yeah, I know what I did then. I bought a fresh turkey.
That did it.
I sure did.
And that's you didn't brine it. Mm-hmm.
You can't high roast a turkey or a chicken unless it's brined.
Okay.
Or butterfly.
Thank you, yeah.
You're welcome.
One more question. With the new range then, the gas range, I always had the assumption that I would be able to boil water instantly with gas, and I find that I am taking longer to boil. I use a French press for my morning coffee,
right.
And so doing my kettle, which I used to use on my electric.
Electric can actually conduct heat better and more of it to a kettle than gas. It depends on the BTU output of your stovetop, which is a measurement of heat output called British thermal units. It used to be that the lower end ranges had 7,000 or 8,000 of British thermal units. These days, a lot of ranges have 12,000 to 15,000, even 20,000. So it's likely that a gas stovetop will probably produce more heat. It's just harder to manage, that's all.
Oh, I see. And would you suggest different pots or something? I mean, larger or smaller, you know, widths?
The only thing I would suggest for boiling water, you just have to wait 2 more minutes. Usually it takes about 13 minutes to boil a gallon of water. That's the typical deal.
Huh.
But what I would do is, if you're going to saute something, put a little bit of oil in it, any kind of oil, and don't put the food in the pan, and put it over medium-high heat.
Oh.
And when it just starts to smoke, just a tiny wisp of smoke, you know the pan's hot, around 450.
Great. Okay.
Even if you have a weak stovetop, as long as you preheat that pan and you have a good quality pan, that'll go a long way to making the food better.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah,
thanks,
you're welcome.
Julie.
Bye.
I got a question about Brussels sprouts. Chris, friends, yes, me too. And one of my favorite recipes is from Cook's Illustrated. It's sort of a creamed Brussels sprout where you chop them up, kind of mince them. But she wants to know if you have any good ideas to convince her family that they'd be worthy of the Thanksgiving table.
Yes, we serve them all the time, especially at Thanksgiving. The best, I just had some 2 nights ago, actually, here in Boston, at a tapas restaurant that's not too far from us, and they roast them.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a nice charred almost outside to them, and it's almost like they're grilled, and they're just delicious. So I would say I wouldn't put a sauce with them. I wouldn't do anything else.
Okay.
You might want to pre-cook them a little bit and then throw them in a very hot oven in a roasting pan uncovered with oil, salt, and pepper, and they're phenomenally delicious. And make sure you're getting, you know, smaller ones, not that are a little more tender as well. But that's all I would do.
And another question, breast up or down with the turkey?
Yeah, you almost always have to flip it. So you start with the breast side down, and you cook it for about half the cooking time, and then you flip it breast side up to finish. If the breast side is up the whole time, the breast meat's going to get overcooked by the time the dark meat comes up. If you cook it breast side down the whole time, you're not going to get the skin rendered properly. So breast side down for about third to half the cooking time, and then finish with the breast side up.
Well, as if we haven't talked about brining enough, I got to take Gordon's question because I'm not sure if we've covered this or not. Gordon, you're asking about drying out brine in the fridge. You're saying it's awkward?
Well, I have two questions. One about this, actually, about this flipping.
Okay.
And that was the main. I tried to follow the Cook's Illustrated new recommendations last year, which involve brining and then taking it out of the brine and letting it dry out, just leaving it open in the refrigerator for a while.
Yeah, you don't have to do that. But the reason that if you have the time to do that and you have room in the refrigerator, which is another issue, is that you're air drying the skin. And regardless of whether you brine chicken or turkey, the idea of air drying, put it on a rack over a half baking sheet and don't cover it, the skin will dry and then it will be rendered in the oven. You get a much thinner, crisper skin. So it's optional, but it does improve the skin.
But when I came to this, the flipping part, I found, my turkey fell apart, basically.
That's happened to me before.
And
you're flipping it long before it's cooked, so it shouldn't be falling apart. You mean it stuck to the V-rack or what?
Yeah, I think it must have stuck. I just remember that, it was very awkward, and I think it did stick, even though I had a Teflon-coated V-rack, and...
The only thing I would do is, even with those nonstick racks, I find they stick too. Mm-hmm. Make sure you spray it with canola oil or whatever. Spray the rack before you put the turkey on. That ought to help.
Uh-huh.
But you're right that those nonstick racks do stick. I've had the same problem.
Spray them. Tool for doing that that would help.
Well, there is a tool, actually. Yeah. There are these turkey forks, mm-hmm. Which we've tested, and they work okay.
Yeah.
What I would do is take two kitchen towels, and you're going to trash them. They're going to have to go to the washing machine.
Sure.
I would just use two towels, and you're not going to burn yourself. Matter of fact, I did buy – you can also buy oven mitts that have a silicone, like Orca mitts or those sorts
mm-hmm.
of things. I use those now because you're not going to burn yourself, and you're covering your forearm because they're long, and they obviously you got to wash them afterwards. But then it's safe, and you can really get your hands on the bird, and that's the best way to do it.
Okay, Gordon.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Thank
yeah.
you. We're almost out of time. I do have one quick email from Lynn. I don't know if she's serious, but she says, if I make the pie crust recipe with the vodka, should I make a disclaimer to the non-drinkers / alcoholics of the group that there is alcohol in the crust?
The alcohol will burn off. You're
right.
You're not going to get any taste, and you're not going to get any alcohol. So no.
That's kind of the idea, is that it burns off.
It burns off.
Okay. Chris, thanks a lot for being on the show today. It's,
yeah,
it's been great. I've enjoyed every minute, and I know the listeners have too. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest today, Chris Kimball, editor of Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country Magazines and host of the PBS's America's Test Kitchen. Thanks again. It's All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.